So in this case, one great newspaper has chosen to present reality in the form of fiction. Increasingly, we expect real life to deliver thrills, once the sole province of fiction, as in TV courtroom dramas torn from the headlines.
The highest moral law in our culture is thou shalt not kill. And where we live, killing in the name of God, country, or brother is still called murder.
But when real-life juries, bred on TV's Law and Order, take their places in the courtroom, their verdict on the experience is likely to be two thumbs down. What's a lawyer to do? Call script consultant Neil Howard. He's worked as a TV writer for shows like King of Queens, but for the last 3 years, he's applied his writing skills to the courtroom. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how did this marriage of your writing background and courtroom consulting begin?
I was watching the Bush-Gore election coverage, actually the struggles in the courtroom, and I was struck by the fact that these were supposed to be some of the best trial lawyers in the country that were presenting these cases. And I was just duly unimpressed from my perspective as a writer, a dramatist, somebody who spent a great deal of time in communications. Shortly thereafter, I happened to meet Andrew Sheldon, who is a well-respected, longtime trial consultant who happened to be working on the Birmingham church bombing case. He thought that the prosecutors on that case would welcome all the help that they could get, and they were very receptive, and we went to work.
So in that trial of Thomas Blanton for the 1963 church bombing, what were the compelling narrative elements that the prosecutors may not have seen, but you did?
In most of these civil rights trials, time is really the most difficult issue, the long passage of time. The sense of relevance and immediacy that is needed to heighten emotion in a courtroom is often lost. You're also dealing with very old evidence, missing evidence, testimony that's being read in transcript as opposed to live witnesses. The two things that you need to do in order to put the narrative in place is figure out how to tell the best story that you can tell given the evidence that you have. Then you can begin to actually craft rhetoric that can play out in a trial theme or over the course of an opening or a closing.
So you look for those clear illustrations.
You might come across a fact like the fact that the force of the blast was equivalent to roughly 20 sticks of dynamite. Well, that's a fact that you can lay out in front of the jury plainly like that. Or you can say, that really was 5 sticks per girl. That's what the defendants calculated it would take to kill each of those children, to destroy hope, to destroy a dream, to destroy a future.
And do you also look to create clear heroes and villains? It's not hard in that case, God knows.
Even in that case, it is difficult because the defendant that is sitting in the courtroom is now a senior citizen and looks like anybody's grandfather. So one of the narrative tricks is to take the audience back in time, the jury back in time, and recreate the scene so that the villain is there in a very palpable and threatening way.
Were there any trials in which finding the winning themes was a very difficult task? Can you give me an example of when you found it and you said, that's it?
In the Mississippi burning trial that just took place, where Edgar A. Killen was convicted of manslaughter, you're faced with a problem like the passage of time. How do you turn that into advantage? So something like no amount of time can forgive their crime, or that they counted on the passage of time to get away with their crime. Time becomes a getaway car. They counted on the existence of racism over the years that would get in the way of a vigorous prosecution of what they had done. Things like that.
You know, some people say that TV has shortened our attention spans, and others say that complicated movies show that audiences can follow a complex story if they're suitable drama. So in your experience, what kind of narrative structure moves juries most?
That really depends on the facts of the case. And then you can make a decision, well, does this need to be told in a traditional sense, starting at the beginning and working your way through the middle and up to the end? Or do you want to do something more along the lines of a Pulp Fiction or a Memento and work from the middle or work backwards or jump around? I think that that's something that attorneys may not necessarily have the training in that a writer would. Part of the mistake that people make is only assuming that jurors, who are really just a reflection of the viewing population of television and film, that the only reason that they're watching those dramas is because they're well written. People have an inherent interest in justice. Justice is something that we are very passionate about, as opposed to, let's say, the finer legal points of the case, which is where the attorneys often spend their time. What jurors are interested in is mostly the spirit of the law and that justice is done.
Aren't some juries so accustomed to courtroom dramas that they're also cynical about lawyers and their motivations and very attuned to real versus fake emotional appeals?
Absolutely. I dare say that perhaps their cynicism might come more from media coverage of real-life trials than it does necessarily from the world of fiction. But nonetheless, yes, they are much more astute at detecting things that don't ring true or insincerity. That's the job of a good writer.
So you've spent time in Hollywood, you've spent time in the courtroom. How long before you start writing courtroom dramas based on cases where you've been a consultant?
I might write a script based on a writer-turned-trial consultant with some fictional cases, perhaps.
So who would you want to play you in the movie?
The script that I'm writing, actually, it's Al Pacino.
All right.
I would be absolutely thrilled if Paul Giamatti would also consider the part.
Neil Howard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Howard is a script writer and a trial consultant in Chicago.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Mike Volo, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Andy Lancet, Simon Jones, Sarah Dalsimer, and Josh Nathan Kazis. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.